Welcome to True Crime Garage. Wherever you are, whatever you are doing, thanks for listening. I'm your host, Nick, and with me, as always, is a man who was a feminist before he even knew what the word meant. He is the Captain.
Thank you. It's good to be seen, and it's good to see you. Happy National Women's Day.
Yeah, cheers to all the lady listeners out there. It's ladies' night in the garage, Captain. We are very happy to be drinking Tweak Bourbon Barrel Aged Stout by Avery Brewing Company.
Tweak yourself.
Garage grade, 4.5 bottle caps out of 5. Check out this American Imperial Double Stout. Reminder, ABV 17.5%, so either stay at home and drink it in your garage or call an Uber and try not to barf in the back seat. Either way, you're going to love this strong, boozy stout with coffee added, aged in bourbon barrels from the very cool people at Avery Brewing. And Tweak was brought to us by these very cool people. First up, we have Jody from Jasper, Georgia. Jody is a big sock club fan, thanks to the Captain.
Next, my kind of lady.
Next, we have Maya in Simi Valley, California. Some very good wine comes out of Simi Valley. Maya says, try some Alesmith IPA out of San Diego.
Done and done.
She says, we love the show. We listen to it as a family. We are all true crime addicts.
Well, we like your family's jib.
Staying out west, let's say hi to Sierra in Bloomington, Utah. And how about a little retaliation here, Captain? Remember, revenge is a dish that is best served cold, my friend. Listen to this. This is from Darren in Madison, Wisconsin. He says, this beer money is for Nick only. I emphasize this must be used by Nick and not the Captain.
We don't like your cheese.
Thank you, Darren. And I can tell, Darren, that you are a very bright and highly intelligent person. So cheers, mate. Next, we have Justin in Quebec. Next, we have Maggie and Nicole in Wisconsin, who says, we send a lot of love to the Captain. So there you go, Captain. You got something a little back there. And also, we have Mandy in Charlotte, North Carolina.
I know it was a competition.
The listeners turned it into a competition.
Yeah.
And last but not least, we have Krista from Port Chester, New York. So thank you to everybody for buying us this round, especially Darren. And if you want to pitch next week's show.
A little note to Darren. If I don't hit record, you can't hear his nasally drone. So I'm going to take a sip of that beer just because, you know, I'm hitting record on that microphone.
Anybody that wants to buy us around for next week's show, go to truecrimegarage.com and click on the donate button.
And like always, we like your team.
If anybody wants to check out our old shows, they're available on iTunes in the iTunes store and also on our website at truecrimegarage.com on the store page.
Also, we'll be putting more videos up on YouTube soon. We got a creepy little video with the creepy photos. Up on YouTube now if you want to check that out. It's basically a video of Nick's nose. But
if you're looking for a nice nose.
Yeah, it's kind of a nose that looks like it sniffed too much glue in elementary school.
Well, we've been adding a lot of videos to that. That's True Crime Garage TV on YouTube. Also, check out our Facebook page, Twitter, Instagram, Untapped, at True Crime Garage.
That's enough for the business.
That's right, everybody. Gather around, grab a chair, grab a beer. Let's talk some true crime.
Except for Darren. No beer for Darren.
Investigators say Bob Evans is responsible for the deaths of Denise Bowden, 4 unidentified people in Allenstown, and Yoon-Soon June. Let's take a closer look at exactly who these victims are. Now, we begin with Denise Bowden, who graduated from Goffstown High School in 1976. She worked at Carroll Cable and the Demers Nursing Home in Manchester before her disappearance. Now, when Bowden was 23 years old, she lived at 925 Hayward Street in Manchester with Evans, who was her boyfriend at the time. Now, shortly after Thanksgiving in 1981, Bowden disappeared, her body never found. 4 years later, the bodies of an adult woman and a female child related to that woman were found in a barrel in a wooded area of Allenstown. The adult described as a white woman with brown hair, 23 to 33 years old. The child described as white and between the ages of 5 and 11. Then in 2000, two more children were found in barrels on the same Allenstown property. Both girls were around 2 or 3 years old. New DNA results show that the girl on the left is the daughter of Bob Evans. And the girl on the right is also related to the unidentified woman found in the first barrel. None of the bodies have been identified. Fast forward a year later, in August 2001, Yoon Soon Jun had an unofficial backyard marriage ceremony with Evans in Richmond, California. She was reported missing in September of the following year and later found buried in her basement. A couple of months later, Evans was arrested and eventually convicted for her murder.
We have been discussing the Allenstown Four, the four unidentified victims that were found in Allenstown.
Mm-hmm.
The first two found in a barrel in 1985. The second two found in a almost exact same similar barrel in 2000. And these victims have remained unidentified. Well, in January of this year, there becomes a huge break in this case.
Yeah.
So the New Hampshire Attorney General announced that they believe that they have discovered the man involved in the Bear Brook murders, also known as the Allentowns Four. To be clear here, the state of New Hampshire Attorney General, he announced in a press conference that after 30-some years of looking, the police are confident in regards to the four female victims found in Allenstown in the two barrels. They now believe that they have their man.
Which is pretty crazy, though, right? Because, I mean, this is the first time that I've ever heard of a case where we identify the murderer,
mm-hmm.
but we still can't identify the victims.
Yeah. And he starts off the press conference by saying that exact same statement.
Really?
Know? Yeah. That usually, you know, you have to, there's that general process that you identify the victims and you take it from there, and then right. you catch the killer. This situation, quite a bit different, but they're putting out this information because they're hoping to receive some information in return. Now, the thing is, we're going to see that there is a lot of information that's still needed on this case. This is going to be something that you're going to see worked very hard in the next year or two,
mm-hmm.
and I think we're going to see further information come out. But let's go through what we do know as of this year. So the New Hampshire Attorney General stated that Robert or Bob Evans is believed to be the killer of these four victims. So who is this Bob Evans? Actually, can we call him Robert Evans, Captain?
That's fine.
I don't want to disturb my weekend breakfast. So Robert Evans is a man that just pretty recently police have been able to place him in New Hampshire as late as 1981. And we will show you how they are able to connect him to the four female victims in Allenstown. But to do so, we have to first talk about California, because Robert Evans was serving a 15-year sentence for murder in California for killing his girlfriend slash wife. This is Unsoon June.
Right, and to do that, we got to go back to the year 2002.
Yeah, September 2002, this story starts off in California's Contra Costa County, and we have a missing persons case. The person in question is Unsoon June. The first signs emerged that there is something that is not right when she did not show up for a scheduled lunch with a friend. She also started missing her regular pottery classes that she attended. A friend of June's was dissatisfied with the answers that she was getting in regards to June's whereabouts from her husband. She stopped believing explanations and excuses as to where her friend was, and then she calls the Contra Costa Sheriff's Department. And the friend decides to file a missing persons report. In this report, the friend states the last time that she had seen Unsoon June was around May 31st, 2002.
And she, at this point, she was married to Robert Evans.
Yeah, they had, some people will refer to them as husband and wife, or they will refer to this Robert Evans as a boyfriend. Because they were married in some like backyard ceremony, so it wasn't like super official. What happens is after that missing persons report is filed, the sheriff's department, their missing persons crime unit, they decide to go do a welfare check at the woman's home, which is located in East Richmond Heights.
Mm-hmm.
The husband, a man who is actually going by the name of Larry Vanner, told the investigators that she was out of the state, and he's very cooperative with the people that
old
that
Larry, show up. You know.
Now we have to kind of touch upon something here, and it's going to come around full circle, and we can explain it as we go. But we're going to start to see a lot of different names in this story, and a lot of those names are being used by one character. So Robert Evans is using multiple names throughout this story, when Larry Vanner and Robert Evans are the same person. We will get into that a little bit later. You'll see how that's connected. So when Larry Vanner, he's so cooperative with these investigators.
We should just say Larry, a.k.a. Robert.
Okay. Larry, a.k.a. Robert, is so cooperative with the investigators that he even agrees to go down to the department to answer some questions regarding the whereabouts of his wife. They interview him for quite some time, and Vanner was given a phone, and he makes a phone call. He calls a number that he calls from memory, which turns out to be a licensed therapist in Eugene, Oregon. Now, the detective would later state how she thought that was really weird, because he had this number memorized and she believed it was part of like a ruse, like the fact that he had gone this far to form some kind of plan in advance. And she couldn't really put her finger on, was this something that he kept in his back pocket as a plan to get out of this particular situation, or really was this something he would do to get out of any situation?
Right.
The detective quickly realizes that the name Lawrence William Vanner, which is the name that the man had given, had no paper trail. He had no driver's license in the state of California. He had no driver's license in any state in the U.S. that they could find. And he had no criminal history or records of any kind. Nothing that they looked for in their databases at the sheriff's department turned up regarding the name Lawrence William Vanner. But this guy, he still agrees to keep talking to her, answering questions, and he even agrees to be fingerprinted. So she also said that they made quite a bit of small talk, and mainly this is because the guy seemed to be very chatty. She also commented that he had these really strange, super blue, twinkly eyes. But as far as questioning went, he was a very personable guy.
Twinkly eyes?
Yeah.
Like the Wiz? From Seinfeld?
Yes, much like the Wiz.
Yeah.
Sometimes Vanner even spoke in a type of like sing-songy voice when they were talking. Anyway, so he gives
I never really understood that sing-songy thing. Does somebody talk like this or something like this?
In every musical that you watch, they do that.
Well, right, but that's an actual song. But sing-songy talk.
Well, Vanner did this from time to time during the questioning process, and he does give his fingerprints, as we said. And while the live scan began to run the prints through the database, the detectives took Vanner out to a corner store so that he could get a drink and a pack of cigarettes. The detective, in an attempt to get some more information about this man, asked him if his accent was from the East Coast. She says to him, "Your accent's very interesting. Where did you grow up?" Vanner then stopped talking and he leaned in real close to the detective's personal space. And with a completely different tone, he said, "That's none of your goddamn business." She said it was like a flick of a switch from the normal behavior that she had seen before. He completely changed.
Con artist.
Yeah. He gets very aggressive with her. And then she says that he then switched it off again, and he kept carrying on as normal, like nothing had happened.
And I'm going to post some pictures of this guy, of old Robert Evans. He's definitely creepy looking. He's like a creepy clown.
Yeah.
You know, he's like a sadistic clown with twinkly blue eyes.
Yeah, he's just got the hair on the sides and none on the top, and he's kind of got that clown face.
Yeah, there's this other picture, too, where he's wearing a Mickey Mouse shirt, and he just, you know, kind of ruined Mickey Mouse for me for the next week or so.
And breakfast. The fingerprints come back, and what they learn from the fingerprints gets even stranger, okay? So this now shows that Larry Vanner was the same person as a man named Curtis Mayo Kimball, a man who was once convicted of abusing and abandoning a little girl at an RV park in 1986. What had happened was he was on parole for that conviction, and he like the day they let him out, instead of checking in and doing all the stuff you're supposed to do on parole to, you know, reincorporate yourself back into society, instead he just takes off. So the detective then reads him his rights, because of course Larry Vanner, he's this Kimball guy, and he's needs to be taken into custody for the parole violation. And of course Larry Vanner at this point stops talking to the detective.
Right. Lawyers up.
They didn't cover that in this portion of the story. I don't think that he actually lawyered up at this point.
Right. He just said, I'm not talking.
Because this is all kind of happening very quickly.
It's none of your goddamn business.
So now
that's what he said to her.
They decide that his premises are subject to a search. So they go and they get the appropriate warrant. And they took a key to June's house from Larry Vanner's belongings, mm-hmm. and then they go to the house. And once there, they find pictures of the missing woman still on the refrigerator. But then they don't find any women's clothing in the house. And then they
at least there's pictures.
Well,
up of her in the house.
It's going to get a little weird, because now they start to notice the weird stuff. There are some areas on the property that look to have been recently dug up. There right. was a dried up dead kitten over the back fence.
That is weird.
Yeah. If you're going to dig up some of the property, at least put the dead cat in one of those holes, right? The garage was padlocked. So they open the padlock to the garage, mm-hmm. and inside they find pottery, a kiln, and a potter's wheel. These are all June's items. At the back of the garage, they find a small door. They open the door. Now, this is a very dark room, so they're using flashlights at this point. They can see a water heater, and near the water heater is a pile of kitty litter. It's mounded over some extension cords.
Yeah.
There are workshop lights that are hung up in this cramped little space. They're not on, but they also see a small axe and a reciprocating saw. Well, this is where they're starting to feel very bad. Now we've got to call in the forensics unit, right? Because this whole place might be a crime scene. So the crime scene unit came in, and they started off by taking photographs of the entire place. Now it becomes time to move the mound of cat litter. So they very carefully moved just a little bit of the cat litter at first. And this is when they discovered a human foot still in a rubber flip-flop. But but it's fully mummified by this point.
Right. But yesterday, the life lesson that we learned, right? What was it? Do you remember? What's the life lesson that we learned yesterday?
Don't go looking in the barrel.
Don't open the barrel.
Yeah, but this is their job. This is different.
I know, but I'm saying it's what you can take away from the show, what you can learn as an individual. This is not our job. Our job is to flex our golden pipes on these microphones. But so, lesson number one yesterday, do not open the barrel.
Mm-hmm.
And lesson number two today is?
Don't move the cat litter.
Don't touch the kitty litter.
Well, so, of course, murder charges followed for the man that they knew as Vanner and Kimball.
Right.
So he is charged as...
real quick question, though. So we know that he is Kimball, right? Yes. Like, he is.
We know that Larry Vanner is Curtis Kimball.
Right. And Curtis Campbell actually has some kind of record. We have fingerprints on file.
Yeah, and that's why I think they charge him as Curtis Kimball and not as this Larry Vanner, because there is some paper trail for Curtis Kimball.
Now, can you explain to me how we get to Robert Evans?
Yes, but it's gonna take a little more a little more explanation. And trust me, this will all come back around full circle at the end, I promise. So he ends up pleading.
Don't you lie to me, boy.
He's charged as Curtis Kimball. But to everyone's surprise, he ends up pleading guilty to the charge. He pled guilty to second-degree murder and was sentenced to 15 years to life in prison.
It's not enough, man.
So what ends up happening, this turns out to be a good thing for Mr. Kimball, a.k.a. Vanner, because this avoids the man a trial and, more importantly to him, an investigation into the man calling himself Lawrence Vanner.
Right.
So the short of that is this detective not only puts this man behind bars, but she establishes through the fingerprint match that Lawrence Vanner is also Curtis Kimball. And Curtis Kimball was wanted on parole violation for abuse and abandonment of a minor that the court system believed to be his child. Now, this awesome detective decides that, you know what? We should trace this guy as far back as we can.
Right.
Because, of course, the thought being here is if he is guilty of this kind of stuff and he has used more than one name, we might want to at least round the bases once to just to be safe to see what else we can dig up in the process.
Right, because we know he's a murderer.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that the whole child pedophilia stuff. Yep. And that's normally repeat offenders.
Yeah. And you know what? My thought here is at the very least, they might want to try to reach out to that child to see what name he was going by when he was connected to that child. Was he Kimball? Was he Vanner? Was he a different name? You know, there's only so much that they even have on this Kimball guy. You know, they traced Vanner to Kimball. They only have one arrest for this Kimball dude. So she tracks Vanner, a.k.a. Kimball, and she figures out that he had a relationship with June that began in 2000. This was the murdered wife. Before that, this detective believes that he had lived and worked in Contra Costa, California from about 1990 to the year 2000. Mm-hmm. So from 1990, before that, there's quite a bit of a gray area because they don't really have much information on him until the year of 1986. As far as this detective is concerned.
Right.
So other than him being arrested in 1986 for the abandonment of a girl that he called Lisa, this was at an RV park in Northern California. She couldn't find anything else on him. And she says, you know, that just didn't make any sense to me that this guy had this little girl in 1986. So what she does is she orders a DNA paternity test in 2003. This is shortly after he pleads guilty to the murder charge. This is to determine whether or not he is the biological father of the girl called Lisa.
Yeah, the one that was abandoned at the RV park.
So what happened is now they've determined, you know, is he the biological father? The DNA tests come in, and it turns out that he, in fact, is not the father of the girl named Lisa.
Right.
So now we have this girl that he had abandoned, and no one knew where this girl had come from. So now we have to go back a little bit further, right? Let's go back to the child abuse abandonment charge that he faced as Curtis Kimball.
Right.
So now we go back to this. This man, Curtis Kimball, shows up in January of 1986. This man is living and working at the Holiday Host RV Park in Scotts Valley. This is in Northern California. And he's living there, working there, and with him is a girl believed to be about 5 years old, and he is calling the girl Lisa.
Mm-hmm.
In June or July of 1986, he leaves Lisa with a family that lives in the RV park. So the way that these charges come about is that after she is living with the family for several months, Lisa starts telling the family about the man who had abandoned her. And she believes him to be her father. But she's telling the family about some of the things that took place. And we don't have details of that. And that's probably a good thing. But what ends up happening is this family then notifies law enforcement to tell them, you know, something, not only was this girl abandoned, but we believe she was abused before she was abandoned.
Right.
And so that's how we get to these charges against Curtis Kimball. Now, we have a very strange situation, though, here, Captain. This is something that doesn't happen very often at all. What the detective quickly realizes is this young girl that was called Lisa, she might have been 5 years old, that just appeared in this RV park.
Right.
Well, now she's an adult and she is basically a living Jane Doe, which you very seldom see that. So Now we have a situation where we have a person that's lived most of their life and they really don't know who they are or where they're from.
Well, and it's creepy stuff. And it kind of makes you wonder, like, when you meet somebody, are they who they say they are?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right, because really, until you see any kind of documentation, you just take people at their word.
It doesn't even matter if you see documentation.
Yeah.
Really, I mean, this guy.
I'm Scott White.
Well, you're definitely vanilla, yeah.
You know what, though? I'm speaking to a guy that uses a an alias, so yeah, maybe you shouldn't be...
They kind of frown upon it if you're teaching children. They frown upon you talking about murders
I get you.
On the internet. That's why that happened. Okay, so let's make some sense of this.
Let's recap this real quickly.
So Robert Evans, we now know that he is responsible for the deaths and the four victims that
were the four unidentified victims in Allenstown, New Hampshire. Yes,
right. And from there, they trace him back to
California.
Mm-hmm.
And the California connection is the murder of his wife or girlfriend that he lived with in 2002,
right, using the name Larry.
Yep, Larry Vanner. Mm-hmm. And from there, with the fingerprint match, they trace him back to that RV park from that charge in 1986 of abandoning a minor with possible abuse. And in regards to that, he was sentenced. I believe it was a 3-year sentence. He served 1 year and then he up and left the first day of his parole.
Right, of course he did. And what I think they should do, and I don't know if they've done this, but have they tested this living Jane Doe's DNA with any of the DNA from the barrels?
I believe that they have, but we're going to get, there's a whole bunch of DNA that comes up out of this, but we will have to get into that after this beer break.
All right. Cheers. And we're back, everybody. Happy Women's Day.
Okay, so the man that we and police in New Hampshire are calling Robert Evans,
mm-hmm,
was living under other names in California.
Old IHOP Evans.
He pleads guilty to the murder of his wife, girlfriend that he lives with. Mm-hmm. And in 2013, that is when the DNA test is requested of or required of this Robert Evans person. So in August of 2013, the DNA testing determines that Robert Evans and Lisa, the girl that he had abandoned at the RV park, mm-hmm, were not biologically related. So now we have a situation where we're trying to initiate an investigation into the true identity of this girl named Lisa. She was living under the name of Lisa Jensen, and that was a name that was given to her by this man. So again, we have a strange situation where we have a living Jane Doe.
Well, and he's good at coming up with names. Mm-hmm. So, he doesn't come up with good names.
No.
But he's just good at coming up with names.
Well, Bob Evans, I mean, he could have seen a sign.
Old IHOP Evans.
Yeah.
Such a douche burger.
So in 2014, San Bernardino, the COSO, enlisted the assistance of DNAadoption.com. Mm-hmm. This is one of those like genealogy type things. You try to find where you came from, your family background.
Well, that's actually interesting because one of the listeners posted yesterday if they did a genealogy on the victims of the barrels,
which is something that police are working on doing right now.
Well, that's good.
So we'll get back to that.
It was a good listener thought, what I was saying. Yeah.
Exactly. Some of these listeners should be involved in these cases.
They are.
With the assistance of DNAadoption.com, they use one of their search angels, is what I guess they call them, a genetic genealogist, to identify links to possible relatives of this Lisa girl.
Mm-hmm.
And what they find, this takes quite a bit of time, but in 2016, they discover a first cousin and the grandfather of Lisa.
Right.
Now, these two people are identified, and they are living in New Hampshire, which led to proving that Lisa had ties to New Hampshire.
Right, which would mean that Robert would have ties to New Hampshire as well.
Exactly. So what they discover after talking with these people, meeting with these people, is that Lisa, in fact, is a girl that was known by the name of Dawn Bowden.
Mm-hmm.
And she happens to be the daughter of a missing person. And this person's name is Denise Bowden. Now, the last known sighting of Denise Bowden would have been in November of 1981. So the police suspect that Denise Bowden, she went missing shortly after Thanksgiving of 1981. And at the time, she had a six-month-old daughter, this being Dawn Bowden. And she had a boyfriend that was going by the name of Robert Evans or Bob Evans.
Mm-hmm.
And they lived in Manchester, New Hampshire. What had happened was she had either spoken to or visited her family for Thanksgiving. And they're not quite sure when these three people kind of disappeared from the area. But they believe that it had to have been after Thanksgiving, but it was definitely before Christmas. So sometime in that early December time period, they believe that these three have disappeared.
And the thing that kind of blows my mind about all this is we have a missing person that went missing in 81.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not until 2016 that she's reported missing.
Correct.
And that's what I was saying before. I mean, the whole idea with, you know, that people live that kind of life or people that have those kind of friends or family around them that would not report them missing. It's a very sad thing, you know.
Well, we don't know the dynamics of their family. It may not have been any wrongdoing on their part. It's definitely strange, 100%. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're talking about many years go by before she's reported as missing.
Right, and then we have that information about the other serial killer, Robinson,
mm-hmm.
and how he would, you know, basically kidnap somebody or take somebody hostage, and then he would write to the parents saying, oh, it's okay, or, you know, I'm moving on with my life. And you were just talking earlier about how you also believe that Robinson would have these victims sign pieces of paper.
Yeah.
And so by having, you know, a signature, maybe type up the letter, but with that signature, you know, the family just kind of believes it. And I think the problem here, though, is, you know, if I was a father and I'm getting some letter from either a guy or I'm getting a letter that's, quote unquote, from my daughter.
Typed, but with her signature.
Right. But then they're trying to tell me that she doesn't want to be a part of my life. Well, again, hopefully I'm not, you know, hopefully I'm a decent father.
Mm-hmm.
And if I was a decent father and somebody wanted to just be rid of me for no reason, you know, I'm going to fight that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but again, like you said, we don't know their social dynamics. So who knows?
The thought here is what the family would tell us in 2016 was that the reason they didn't report either the mother or the daughter as being missing was that it was presented to them. Now, it's unclear to us, the general public, if it was Robert Evans presenting this to them or if it was their own daughter presenting this to them, Denise Bowden. But it was presented to them that they basically owed a whole bunch of money to everybody in the area of Manchester, New Hampshire, where they lived.
Mm-hmm.
So the thought was they were going to uproot, move elsewhere, transplant, and set up shop elsewhere and create a new life somewhere debt-free.
Right.
The family probably thought they were doing their daughter some favors by not leading the possible debt collectors to her. That being the thought. Again, 30 years go by, it's strange.
Yeah, again, maybe you don't hear from the first Christmas and, you know, nothing, you know, no big deal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's starting her new life. But by the second Christmas, I'm looking for this person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, how can you just let your daughter just disappear almost?
Yeah. And I said, you know, we don't know if it was Robert Evans that presented that story to them or if it was their own daughter. My guess is it might have been the daughter presenting it because the vibe I got from the attorney general and from the officers that were explaining this whole situation to the public, the vibe I got was that the family was not a fan of this Robert Evans. Like, that he was somebody that they didn't like from the get-go.
Which is more of a reason to go find him, punch him in his stupid fucking face, and then
his clown face,
and then pee in his little twinkly eyes. I'll make his little eyes twinkle.
Wow, just
his face.
It just got real.
No, because here's what I'm getting pissed off about it. Because what we're seeing is the cycle, and it involves pedophilia. Mm-hmm. That's what it involves. That's what it comes down to. Why was this girl missing for 30 years? Because she had a daughter. He preyed on her. And it was the daughter. He wanted the daughter. And you see this time and time again where these douchebaggers come out and they prey on single mothers with daughters or sons, and they molest those kids. And then once the mother finds out about it, well, now you got to kill the mother. Mm. And that's what this Robert Evans was doing time and time again.
Mm-hmm.
Was getting into situations, and I guarantee you, his girlfriend / wife, that's probably why she ended up dead and why they found her at her house dead, because she probably figured out that he was doing this shit.
Or figured out that he had some very sketchy past. You know, anything's possible regarding that. We should state very clearly here that Denise Bowden is still technically a missing person. She's not been identified as having been found anywhere or,
she's dead
or to be living anywhere. And you're exactly right. The way that this has been presented by the Attorney General is that they expect that knowing Robert Evans' past and knowing what he's capable of, they firmly, and the amount of time that's gone by, frankly, they firmly believe that they're looking for remains as far as Denise Bowden would go.
All right, so let's connect this all together.
Yeah, so in the summer of 2016, the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Office, they contact the Manchester Police Department regarding the identification of Don Bowden. So Lisa Jensen, the girl that was left at the RV park, is actually Don Bowden, the daughter of Denise Bowden.
And I'm so glad that they did their work so she at least has some closure and that she has some sense of an actual past before this monster.
Yeah, can you imagine that, though? This Lisa girl, she's living with the name Lisa for all these years, and she was adopted out and went on to live a very normal, happy life from what we have heard. Can you imagine that situation, though, that you really basically have no family background or understanding of your family background or where you came from. You don't know your mom.
Well, sometimes I wish I didn't know my family background.
You have this guy that you think is your father that probably abused you. At the very least, he abandoned you. And so you probably consider yourself lucky to have survived and got out of that situation. And then all these years later, you're contacted. You're living your normal life, you know, and you're doing your normal things. And then you get contacted and you're told, you know, that guy that left you at the RV park, we figured out that was not his real name and he's not your father. So, sorry, I got sidetracked there. But back to the summer of 2016, this is when California contacts the New Hampshire Manchester Police Department regarding the identification of Don Bowden, the girl, in connection with a missing female, Denise Bowden, the mother, and they let them know that the person that they suspect of being involved in this disappearance would be a person that they've already convicted of homicide in 2002.
Right.
So that same year, a multi-agency investigation begins to determine that Robert Evans, they determine his connections to Manchester, New Hampshire, and Allenstown, New Hampshire.
What's the major connection between old Robert IHOP Evans and the four in the barrel?
So in October of 2016, they take Robert Evans' DNA profile. Remember, they already have this from checking with the Lisa girl. And they compare that profile to all of the three female, these are the minor female victims that were found in Allenstown.
Right.
Well, the results showed that Robert Evans was the father of the middle child. Remember, this is the child that is non-maternally related to the other victims.
Mm-hmm.
So what are the Allenstown connections beyond that of the DNA? This is what the officers are able to determine, that at some point in the late 1970s, a man that shows up using the name Robert T. Evans, or to friends or coworkers, he's known as Bob Evans, that he lived and worked in Manchester, New Hampshire. He worked at the Wombeck Mills in Manchester as a mechanic and electrician.
Mm-hmm.
When he was working there, he worked with the owner of the property in Allenstown where the barrels with the bodies in them were found in 1985.
Right, because there was that little store.
Yeah, and in 2000. He provided electrical work to the Bear Brook store that was located on that property. Here's the thing, though, too. That makes you wonder, Captain, once you kind of see this situation with Robert Evans and you know that a lot of these crimes might be driven by his pedophilia.
Right.
And then we hear about the owner, his last name was Callahan, that owned that property, worked with him at the Wombeck Mills. Doesn't it make you wonder, does this Callahan character, with his background in pedophilia, do you wonder if there's some kind of connection there? It seems a little too big of a coincidence to me, right?
Mm-hmm. A couple questions initially that come up. One, was it the pedophilia that brought them together and then they decided to, you know, work together? Or was it through work? An odd conversation. I don't know how that conversation starts, but I don't want to ever have that happen. I think I'd just slap the person. But then a weird thought kind of popped in my head. What if a lot of this pedophilia stuff, what if this other guy wasn't actually that involved?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And it was just happenstance or something.
It's possible. The thing here is, you imagine if this Callahan guy is guilty of lesser crimes, I don't think he's letting somebody dump bodies on his property.
Right.
Actually, guilty or not guilty of anything, you're not letting people dump bodies on your property.
Well, and this starts making me feel a little more like the whole idea of sex trafficking, human trafficking.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, it appears to be something of that nature. We have these unidentified people that one could think partly they're unidentified because they were brought into that area. Another connection here is that the first barrel that was found with the adult and the oldest child that were dismembered in this barrel. Remember, they were found in trash bags, but these were multiple trash bags. So what Robert Evans did, or whomever placed them there did, was to package these things together. The trash bags were tied together with electrical wire. Now, mm-hmm. We already said that he has a background as an electrician.
Right, so that makes sense.
This electrical wire could potentially be traced back to a place called Carroll Cable. Mm-hmm. Now, this is interesting because that is where Denise Bowden worked. So, I do want to throw this out there, though. It is a bit of a loose connection because it's been presented to me that type of cable, that type of wire, was actually a very common type of wire. But again, here, it would be another big coincidence.
Right. Well, but the fact of the matter with the old Denise case is he had her daughter. He took mm-hmm. her daughter across the country. We see this pattern with him, you know, as far as murders go.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so we don't have to sit there and say, well, he had some cable because he probably worked at this cable company. That's where she worked. That's another nail in the head. I don't need any more nails in the head, you know, this guy.
Right. I think it's more of a connection to the four unidentified bodies. In regards to Denise Bowden, there were people that provided law enforcement with pictures of this Robert Evans with Denise Bowden. So it's not mm-hmm. just somebody coming forward and saying, well, I know this Robert Evans guy was with Denise Bowden. No, they have photographic proof. Some other kind of loose ends here we have with the Allenstown victims. Remember the girlfriend, wife that he killed in California? All five of these victims died from blunt force trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And the several, almost all of these victims as well were dismembered. So we see a bit of a pattern as far as cleaning up a scene and getting rid of bodies.
And through investigation, they were able to uncover that Robert Evans was known to actually dump stuff on the site before.
Yeah, and they had confirmed that barrels from the mill, from the Wambach Mill, were dumped on the property as well. Now, what they're saying in regards to the actual two barrels where the bodies were found stuffed into is that these, they're not, they can't place them as having come from the Wambach Mill, but it makes sense.
I mean, they're similar.
They're very similar, yes.
And then sometimes, you know, if you work in any warehouse, you know, sometimes you have like everything normally comes in this crate or in this barrel, right? But then every now and then you just get a couple crates or a couple barrels that look a little different.
Get a one-off.
Right. And those might have been put to the side and he possibly could have used those because they weren't using them at his work.
That, now, remember we had said that they were able to establish that at some point in the late 1970s that Robert T. Evans had moved into the Manchester, New Hampshire area. They have him living there until approximately 1981 when he leaves with Denise Bowden and her daughter. They are able to confirm, they don't know the exact time or date that he would have moved into this property, but they have him as living at a, at 925 Hayward Street in Manchester, New Hampshire. Now, what has taken place since all of this uncovering has happened is that they have gone back to that property. And mainly they went back there to look for the remains of Denise Bowden.
Right.
They spent almost, I think they spent 3 or 4 days there with FBI and other agencies involved, and they were unable to find any trace of remains, human remains, or Denise Bowden.
And the problem is it's 30-some years later.
So, of course, police are still looking for Denise Bowden. She's been missing since November of 1981. She was 23 years old at the time that she had disappeared or was last seen. She had brown hair, brown eyes. She was about 5'4" to 5'6" tall, 120 to 140 pounds. She had a noticeable overbite. And as we had said, she was known to have been living in the Manchester, New Hampshire area. The problem, though, is when you have a guy like Robert T. Evans, who moves all over the country with all these different names, you don't know where you could potentially find this person. She might even be a Jane Doe in some other state that, that's been sitting there waiting to be named all these years.
Did they do a DNA test between the girl that he left abandoned and the girls that were in the barrel?
To see if there was some kind of connection there?
Yeah.
There, I believe they have, and I believe that there is not any type of connection to them as far as being relatives.
So I would just be, it would be suspect to me that that the middle child that they believe is connected to Bob Evans or Robert Evans would be maybe related to the Bowdens.
Yeah. Anything's a possibility at this point. So what do we, let's try to point out what we think we know about Robert Evans. Because we have these little patches in time where we don't have information on where he is. And this becomes a big problem because we're starting to see what this guy is probably capable of. I mean, he's a chameleon, right? He's a guy that moves into an area.
Well, no, I mean, here's what we do know is we do know that he's capable of kidnapping. We know he's capable of abandoning children.
Mm-hmm.
We know that he's capable. He has, you know, worked and probably was in cahoots with a pedophile, with a known pedophile, and he's capable of murder.
Right.
So we know he's capable of a lot.
And it's very, it's not, it's very likely that he's a serial killer that's been moving around this country for decades. So the police estimate that Robert Evans was born between the years of 1936 and 1952. Well, that's quite a span of time there. That's 16 years of not being able. That's scary when you have this guy that you're saying he's our number one suspect. He's probably guilty of this, but we don't even know if this is his real name, and we can't tell you how old he is either. So the reason, the way that they come up with these years as having been possible birth dates that he was born sometime during this time is that on, you know, certain paperwork that he had filled out over the years, he used different dates that fell within this range. He did die in prison in December of 2010. So he will be unable to face justice regarding these victims that we have in Allenstown. He's also going to be unable to provide us with any information as to who he is or potential additional victims that he may have.
Well, I can tell you who he is.
Well, he changed his name, obviously, frequently. He had some, there's a lot of suspected aliases, but we can go through the confirmed aliases. He had lived or worked under these names at one time or another. This being Robert T. Evans, also Curtis Mayo Kimball, Gerald Mockerman, Gordon Curtis Jensen, and Lawrence William Vanner, which was the name that he was using when he murdered his girlfriend that he was living with.
Yeah.
Occupations, he had worked at different times as an electrician or a mechanic. They have a suspicion that he might have possibly worked at the Manchester, New Hampshire VA. And here's one thing that they're really looking into right now regarding him is that they suspect he might have some form of military background, and they even kind of specified that they believe it might be the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And this just being because of the way that he would write dates, the way that he carried himself, the way that he talked to people, at different jobs that he had had. And they even say that he was known to kind of rig things rather than fix them, that he would rig them in a manner that would be something that they would be used to seeing in a military fashion.
Right. So he would kind of jerry rig a bunch of stuff. And, but he was also a known alcoholic as well.
Yeah. They believe that he was probably an alcoholic for most of his life.
Kind of like when he got cigarettes and booze and said, "None of your goddamn business."
Yeah.
It's none of your goddamn business if I'm an alcoholic.
Well, and he was obviously, you know, as far as characteristics go, he was obviously a transient. And they can confirm that he, throughout his life, lived in different campgrounds, trailer parks, and motels. You know, not really laying roots in too many places or too many places for a very long period of time. Confirmed locations. Now, this is important because they're trying to figure out, one, where this guy was from. You know, he pops up on the map in the late 70s. They have nothing of him before that. But his confirmed locations would be, obviously, New Hampshire and in California. But right. They also have tied him to the state of Idaho. And this is because he was arrested in the mid-80s in California with a stolen vehicle from the state of Idaho. Now, what they're really looking for and hoping for is that somebody comes forward and says, you know what, I knew the guy that stole my vehicle, or he lived down the street and he went by this name.
Right.
So those are the confirmed locations. They have some possible locations where they think that he may have lived.
Well, cause he could have possibly been in jail for other murders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so the possible locations of where he may have lived at some point would be the state of Washington, Oregon, Arizona, Wyoming, Colorado, Missouri, Virginia, Georgia, Louisiana, Hawaii, a small part of Canada, and Quebec, Canada.
Well, possibly Hawaii. I mean, that would make sense if he was in the Navy.
Yeah, he could have been stationed there for whatever reason. And also the state of Texas. Now I do want to throw this out there. This guy is obviously not to be believed on anything. You know what I mean? That we people that tell stories and you say, well, take what they say with a grain of salt. I don't even think you use a grain of salt when you're talking about Robert Evans here.
Mm-hmm.
These are locations that they question because he has some ties or he has mentioned these places to people at some point in his life. Right. Now, any of those background stories that he was giving to these people could be completely fabricated.
Right, complete malarkey.
Yeah, they seem to be really focusing on the state of Texas as far as law enforcement goes. They're really interested in the state of Texas.
And I think what's going to come down to is they're doing a lot of hard work, and I'm grateful for them to do that because there are other missing person cases. There's probably other John Doe's, probably Jane Doe's in this scenario, but there's missing person cases. There's Jane Doe's out there. that are connected to this guy.
Yep.
And they just need to keep doing the work to do that and maybe bring closure to somebody.
Mm-hmm. And well, then that leads us perfectly into this, because then you start to wonder Bob Evans, Robert Evans, his victims and potential victims. Who would be his potential victims? Well, obviously the Allenstown Four, which seems like he's very, very likely the guilty person in that situation. Mm-hmm. We also have the disappearance of Denise Bowden, who's still not been found, who went missing in 1981.
Right.
Of course, his ex-wife, ex-girlfriend that he killed in California.
Mm-hmm.
But we also have the mother of the middle child in Allenstown.
Right.
We have this whole other woman that's not, we don't have a name for her. We don't know anything about this person.
Right.
This is a whole potential victim that we don't know anything about. Now, there is some suspicions regarding some possibilities of who could be that middle child's mother. And this being a woman that they are trying to figure out if she even existed or not. And her name would be Elizabeth Evans. So in January of 1980, a certified letter addressed to Robert Evans was signed for by a person by the name of Elizabeth Evans. And at two points mm-hmm. in that same year, he was arrested. And on both of those times, he listed his spouse's name as Elizabeth. Now, the strange thing here, though, is on a later arrest date in October of 1980, he's arrested again. And this time he does not list a spouse. So,
right.
Again, they're unable to confirm if this person even exists or not, or could it be somebody living under an alias that's traveling along with him?
Right. Well, but by force, you see what
mm-hmm.
I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's more likely if he was traveling with somebody. Again, he's either conning them or it's by force,
mm-hmm.
and he's holding people, and that goes back to the whole sex trafficking.
And if this Elizabeth Evans person is not the mother of the middle child, well, then you increase your potential victim list by another person. It's a crazy case. One of the strangest that I've seen. I got to say here though, Captain, what really kind of drives this whole thing and what I'm really excited about is to see somebody in law enforcement take it the extra steps. That detective that put him away for murder in California back in 2002, I love that she gets a gut feeling that something just doesn't sit right with her. And she decides, you know what? We're going to mandate this dude take a DNA test.
Yeah.
Because this guy's passed away since then. If this went unnoticed back then, we would be sitting here with knowing, I know we have a whole bunch of extra questions involved, but we'd be sitting here with no answers at all. She not only did her darndest to put him behind bars.
You know, and we don't have a lot of cases where we have talked about, you know, women in law enforcement. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of serendipitous.
Since then, she has been promoted to captain. And,
that's awesome.
And she is nearing retirement.
She's a captain.
Yeah, she's a captain just like you. But she's a captain of a much bigger, prestigious garage than this one. I'm
captain,
for sure.
My captain.
That's right.
So I salute her.
She's coming up on retirement, and she said that she is hoping to.
There's nothing wrong with older ladies.
All right, you can send her some fan mail on your own time.
How about some flowers,
or some socks,
or say yeah, hey.
But she's coming up on retirement. She does say that she plans to assist the New Hampshire State Police, even well into retirement, as far as Robert Evans is concerned.
Well, here's what I like about it. Is normally when law enforcement gets the man, right, mm-hmm. they get who they think is responsible for a murder or for a crime. It normally stops, right? Man, we don't need to go any further. And yeah, I understand that we're going to keep diving into this Robert Evans guy because we want to know if he had any other victims. And can we bring closure to anybody else?
Mm-hmm.
But we still have these four unidentified people in these barrels. And we're going to continue to do some work to try to figure out who they are.
Mm-hmm.
Because they deserve answers. You know what I mean? They deserve an end of their story.
And they believe that with presenting to the public who this killer is, who killed those people, that they think that now they might be able to put an identity to these people by tracing it through that of Robert Evans or any of these other aliases that he had given throughout the years.
And what was so great is, you know, I posted, you know, the DNA where they reconstruct what they think they would look like. I posted that picture on our Instagram and Twitter and everything, and a lot of people retweeted it. And, you know, I mean, that's nice because it, you know, promotes the show, but it's also just to get this picture out there. How many of hundreds? I mean, here's the thing that drives me insane is that somebody like, you know, Kim Kardashian or somebody will post something on the internet and it's millions and millions. And for what? You know, nobody, you know, put your fat ass away, you know, and you go ruin another guy's career. Kanye hasn't put out shit since he's been with you. Nothing good anyways. But if people of that power, if they put out this picture and millions of people saw, then maybe we get some closure in some of this stuff.
Yeah, and I'm hoping that this thing catches fire because, you know, the weird thing in researching this case, first of all, it wasn't a case that I knew too much about. And when I started diving into it, I started seeing, you know, witnesses, people coming forward in the state of New Hampshire that are saying, I shouldn't say witnesses, these are people being interviewed for news, stating that, you know what, I hadn't heard of this case until 5-6 years ago, which is crazy. I mean, it's four bodies in a barrel, but again, it never went anywhere.
The longevity of this, you know, starting way back in the 80s, and then, you know, almost 15 years later, then another barrel, and then almost another 15 years later, DNA evidence, and now we have a guy. We still have four victims that remain nameless.
And they're working very hard. They got a lot of leads that they're working on. One of those being something you mentioned earlier, where they are going to use those same ways that they found out who Lisa Bowden was. They're using those same methods to try to trace genealogy with the three and four unknown victims in Allenstown.
Well, hopefully we get some answers.
The thing here is, though, I you touched upon something too that I want to just take a quick second to mention. You know, they're really curious about the state of Texas for some reason, and they won't fully disclose why. My suspicion, you said something, maybe he had served time in prison at one point. And maybe that's why he just kind of pops up on the map all of a sudden in 1977. And you would think, yes, you could connect him via the fingerprints to an inmate, but maybe they've not tested it against the right sample. The thing here is, I wonder...
One is also so old.
Yeah. Know. And remember when we covered the yogurt shop murders, we talked about how the state of Texas was releasing prisons due to overcrowding in the 70s. This guy just pops up all of a sudden in the 70s. They're focusing on the state of Texas. I'm curious if he might have served some time in the state of Texas. Maybe the other thing, though, is he's a runaway that joined the military or the Navy, and he doesn't pop up until he gets out of the Navy. It's a fascinating case. I really do think that we're going to see a lot of information come out regarding Robert T. Evans and hopefully these unidentified victims within this next year.
Again, yeah, hopefully we get some answers. And again, thanks for sharing all the stuff on social media. And do we have a recommended reading for this week?
We do. We have a recommended reading and a recommended viewing. First up, the reading, of course, the book we discussed yesterday, Expecting to Die by Lisa Jackson. That's a fictional thriller. You can pick that up. We have that listed on our recommended page on our website, and you can pick that up through the Amazon banner there. And for a recommended viewing, I'm pretty pumped up about this, Captain. It's called Capture, Kill, Release. It's about a young married couple that documents their descent down the rabbit hole as they seek to fulfill one of their darkest desires. This is loosely based off of the real-life Ken and Barbie murders, which, of course, is one of the most famous cases from our brothers and sisters up north in Canada. So check out Capture, Kill, Release. That just came out this week, and that's available on Amazon as well.
Again, big happy, 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 happy Women's Day. So proud of you, crazy freaks that listen to murder shows. Anyways, thanks for listening. Thanks for the support, and we'll see you next week.
And until then, be good, be kind, and don't litter.
Except for your sticker.